We the People.
We the People.
We the People of the United States.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine, and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of man, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves. Over the next 3 years, the states would debate its ratification. This is the story of those men and their times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday, a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show. The American democracy, founded on the ideas of the God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, was now on trial before the entire world. Anxious empires awaited the outcome of the convention with their eyes on what would be left to take, should the Americans fail to restore good government and end up going their separate ways. The Philadelphia Convention did not get off to a prompt start, as heavy rains had turned every road into the city to rivers of mud. By the assigned starting date, only 8 delegates had arrived. It was an inauspicious beginning to the last-ditch attempt to save the United States of America.
Some 8 months earlier, in Annapolis, Maryland, 5 of the 13 United States had gathered to meet to discuss the remedies for the defects in the federal government. It was a national political convention, early September, kind of mid-September, I guess is more accurate. 12 delegates showed up, 5 states, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia, which is kind of interesting because really the impetus for this particular convention was found in Virginia and Maryland, who had, in defiance of the Articles of Confederation and the Continental Congress, had worked out a deal amongst themselves for the navigation of the Chesapeake Bay between the two states. The deal was actually working so well that they had decided, the two states, Maryland and Virginia, had decided to invite Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Delaware to come in on the deal as well and start working with them on this navigation of these waters deals that was outside of the realm of the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation that was in place at the time. You need to understand that this was illegal. In other words, what Maryland and Virginia had done was not permissible under the Articles of Confederation because all 13 states would have had to agree to it, and they had not only had they not done so, but in other cases we'd seen where one state, of course, on a fairly regular basis, usually Rhode Island, although occasionally it was New York or one of the other states, had basically thrown up a roadblock in the way of Congress and the way of doing things. Even that is something of an oversimplification of things. Reality is that all of the states, as Madison observed, were being quite selfish when it came to what worked to their advantage. Some states, like North Carolina, was particularly at the mercy of both South Carolina and Virginia. And North Carolina, if you don't know, doesn't have real good ports on its coast. It has a couple of minor ports, but nothing really, really good for importation and even exportation. However, South Carolina, of course, has Charleston, and Virginia has Norfolk, and both of these were basically on either side of North Carolina. North Carolina was essentially being bled dry by both Virginia and South Carolina with import taxes and excise fees and the likes of that. It wasn't the spirit of 76 by any stretch of the imagination. And as Madison observed, the states were being very selfish and very self-directed, even though Congress tried to tell them not to. And we talked a little bit back at the beginning of this in February about the reasons why a constitution needed to be adapted. The truth of the matter is that without such a constitution, without a radical change in our government, the United States was going to fall as a nation. It was going to fail as a nation. It was going to break apart, probably more along regional lines than on state lines, but it wasn't going to last. And the entire world was watching this. You need to understand that it wasn't just issues with England. There were issues with France. There were issues with Spain. There were issues with Holland. There were issues with everybody. And everybody was watching what was going on to see what the United States was going to do, because it was clear that these people, these men, these women, these states, which had separated themselves from England with declaring themselves to have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, were struggling to make that happen. And after 5 years of essentially independence, well, 3 years after winning independence, but 5 years really of a functional Confederacy, things were reaching the point where it was do or die. It really was. And it was more than just the issues with England, and it was more than just the issues with Spain. And we found ourselves in a position where states were literally stabbing each other in the back over issues. And yet, anytime the federal government wanted to do something, it required all 13 of the states to agree. And what would happen were things like the government didn't have any money. Of course, it could only raise money, for example, by requesting or demanding money from the states on an apportioned basis. Now, interestingly enough, the scale that they used to apportion this initially was land values. So there was supposed to be surveys done that showed the value of each land appropriated to each state. And based on that land value, they were supposed to be assessed a value that they would then forward on to Congress, that Congress would then use for running the federal government, doing all the things that it needed to do. Of course, the problem was that the states quickly discovered that if they just didn't survey the land, Congress wouldn't have anything to go on. Some states quickly figured this out. Some states didn't quickly figure this out. Some states, believe it or not, tried to play by the rules and forwarded on the appropriate amounts of money. Well, what ended up happening was as predictable as a sunrise, of course. The states that didn't do this, Congress just sort of ran out of, well, we can't make them do it. So what they did was they started increasing the apportionment of the states that were playing by the rules. So they were getting doubly taxed, I guess is the best way to put it, while some states were not paying anything at all. Now, we don't like to think of ourselves in those kind of terms, but this is the point where the United States had kind of reached by the fall of 1786. And commerce had become, of course, the primary issue. As Madison wrote, the Americans are an agricultural and trading people. And I thought to myself as I was reading that the other day that what an apropos description of Americans. An agricultural and a trading people. We like to grow stuff and we like to trade stuff. We like to sell, we like to buy, and we like to grow. And even today, that's really true. That's really who we are. And that's part of, it's kind of off topic here, but if I had to talk about why we seem to be struggling so much as a nation, I think it's because we forgot some of that element of ourselves. We're a consumer nation now. We like to consume things now, but we don't seem to like to make things for other people. We don't like to seem to trade. And maybe that's our fault, maybe it's somebody else's fault, but it seems like it's part of that. And if you start talking about growing things, well, all you got to do is look back at the LA Times last week and their ridiculous, hey, farming's only 2% of the GDP, so it's not important argument to see that we've kind of lost focus on growing things. Anyway, put all that aside for a moment. Madison understood that commerce was going to be the lifeblood of the nation. And the way commerce was working under the Articles of Confederation was very poorly, because each state, again, was doing what was to its own advantage. For example, as I talked about, North Carolina had issues. New Jersey had issues, because New Jersey, basically between New York and Philadelphia. You don't really think about ports in New Jersey. Now, today there are some, but in those days, not quite so much. New Jersey was kind of getting pinched between the two, and they didn't particularly like that. And so there were these problems. One of the biggest problems, of course, was the navigational waters of the Chesapeake Bay. Who controls what? Virginia and Maryland made this brilliant plan to work together on that. But the problem with the plan was Congress never approved it. But they didn't care. They just went ahead and did it anyway. Then they invited Pennsylvania in on it. They invited Delaware. They invited New Jersey in on this plan. And all of this led to this convention being called in September of 1786 to talk about, hey, let's see if there's something we can do to remedy the problems we're having with the federal government, particularly as they relate to commerce, because this is the lifeblood of our nation. Now, this particular convention was not successful in the broader sense. Nothing came out of this convention that solved any problems. And you need to understand, only five states, like I said, showed up. And of that, there weren't a whole lot of people that actually went. Egbert Benson, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton went because, as you may know about him, he is an economy guy, and he was deeply concerned about commerce. He goes. From New Jersey, Abraham Clark, William Houston, James Shuraman. From Pennsylvania, a guy by the name of Tench Cox, which is a name that you may not know, but you should, and we'll get into him a little bit later. Delaware, George Reed, John Dickinson, Richard Bassett. And from Virginia, names that you should be fairly well familiar with, Edmund Randolph, James Madison, and St. George Tucker. And from this convention, though, came a report. And the report was sent to Congress in the states. And essentially, the report was a request to have a broader constitutional convention to be held the following May in Philadelphia. The report is received by Congress, it's received by the states, it's agreed to, oddly enough, by everyone, pretty much, with the exception of Rhode Island. And everybody agrees that we should get together next May 14th in Philadelphia, and let's talk about what we need to do. The legacy of the Annapolis Convention is that it was the turning point, really, of the decision-making process. It was the decision to make a change, or at least seriously look at making a change. And it was noted around the world. The French newspapers in particular picked up on the fact that it wouldn't make any sense if it was the British, but picked up on the fact that the Americans had decided that their failing form of government wasn't going to work, and that they were going to try to fix it. But this was with the understanding, of course, that failure to fix it would be disastrous. There was going to be a convention. There was going to be a restructuring of this government some way or another, or the Union was going to fail. And, of course, if the Union failed, then everything that we had fought for in 1776 was essentially pointless. And so the convention in Annapolis sends its report out. These are accepted. And the states begin to appoint their convention delegates, who will then make their way to Philadelphia with a starting date of May 14th. That's the goal. On May 13th, George Washington will arrive to great cannon fire and salutes and all sorts of things. James Madison arrives actually on May 3rd, and he comes equipped basically with his own traveling library that he is going to use quite extensively during these discussions and these debates. They are primarily histories that have been sent to him by Thomas Jefferson in Paris, because he wants to make sure that there is information available to Madison to do this. Philadelphia is one of the largest cities in the United States at the time. It has a population of about 40,000 people, but it's also a very popular destination for conventions. In fact, even as the conventional delegates gather, there is a convention of the Order of Cincinnatus. The Revolutionary War officers who are part of that is in town, and of course they're excited to see Washington, who's one of their members. And there is a convention of Presbyterian ministers in town. There is virtually no hotel space left, no boarding space left in Philadelphia. And these 55 delegates that are eventually going to show up, in many cases, are scrambling to find a place to stay during this convention because, as I said, there's a lot going on in one of the busiest cities in the United States of America. And so it was that on May 14th, they went to start the convention and discovered that only 8 people had showed up. The nation had been hit by quite a storm in the previous days, and travel, of course, was by horseback and foot, and most of the delegates had been significantly delayed. In fact, we're going to find that it's as much as a week before anything really gets going. But it was this day, May 14th, 1787, that the convention officially opened in Philadelphia. It's Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show.
This is The Scotsman.
And this is Drew.
And we are The Ale Evangelist Show, spreading the good news of good booze across the land.
Wine is nice, but beer is better.
It is indeed. So tune in to us on the Podcast 99 Network, where California comes to talk, www.podcast99.com.
I'm Jeff.
I'm Pat.
And check us out on Lawless Chat, where we discuss topics from A to Z.
And from Z to A.
And from soup to nuts.
And from nuts to soup, pretty much everything under the sun.
Catch us on a weekly podcast on Podcast 99 Network.
With the start of the convention, we're going to take a little bit of a different direction, I suppose, on Constitution Thursday, the Plausibly Live episodes anyway. The Saturday podcast with Jeff and Pat will continue to look at some case law and some things that are affecting you each day. But for the next 5 months, at least here on Plausibly Live, Constitution Thursday, we're going to take a little bit different tact. We're going to actually follow the convention as it goes through its process. We're going to talk about the debates that they have. We're going to summarize the previous week in its entirety as to what has happened at the Constitution Convention, what's going on, what's coming up, what kind of things you need to be paying attention to, and how we got to the form of government in the Constitution that we're going to end up with. Now remember, over the course of this summer, 55 men are going to show up at various points during this convention. Not all of them will stay for the whole thing. Not all of them will be there for every debate. And when everything is said and done, only 39 of them will sign the document saying that they approve it. Some very important names, George Mason, will not sign it. They will object to the plan, and you'll see why they object to the plan. And we'll have a chance to go through some of their arguments and see if perhaps there wasn't some validity to what they had to say about the flaws that they opposed in the overall Constitution. It's going to be an interesting time, I think, because we're going to look at this from a completely different perspective. We're not looking at it from the Federalist Papers, where the people who are very pro-Constitution are explaining to us what it means, nor are we looking at it from a case law standpoint where courts have decided how to interpret it. What we're going to actually look at are the actual debates of that day, the people who were there in Philadelphia, what they said, what they thought. And in many cases, what we're going to discover is there is as much significance in what they said about a certain clause or a certain passage of the Constitution as there is in what they did not say in those arguments. For example, we're going to talk about how we elect Congress, the plan for how we apportion Congress and how we elect Congress. And when you look at it, particularly in light of things like the national popular vote and fair vote and those sorts of movements that are gaining popularity now, what we're going to discover is that Congress, the Constitutional Convention, considered some of those things and rejected them. And in more of what they rejected than what they accepted, do we find the basis for how we do things now? It's kind of an interesting look at some things, and I'm hoping that over the next 5 months you will find this interesting and you will find it unique in your study of the Constitution, and hopefully it will give you a better idea when we talk about originalism, what better place to go than the actual debates themselves, the actual discussions of the Constitution as it was being written, to see what they originally intended. George Washington would later say, look, it's the best we can do. It's not perfect, but it's the best that we are going to be able to do. And asked everyone to support it. We'll see why he thought that. We'll see why some of the folks refused to sign it. And we will get to meet people that perhaps you have never heard of in your life. The delegates who attended the Constitutional Convention were a collection of, as Jefferson put it, demigods. They were the cream of the crop. And hopefully over the process of this time, you're going to meet as many of them as we can possibly work into the discussions of the day. There are men that you are well familiar with, as I said, George Washington, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and so forth. But there were a lot of people who you don't know. There are people who you've heard of through Constitution Thursday. We've talked at length about Gouverneur Morris and some of the stuff he did. But George Wythe is in there, which is kind of an intriguing guy to me. I know several people from Wytheville, Virginia, who his name brings to mind his actions and his input into all these things. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, Charles Pinckney, Pierce Butler, names that you, again, may not know, but were part of this whole process as we begin to go through this. From Connecticut came William Samuel Johnson. William Samuel Johnson was a son of the first president of King's College, which was later Columbia College and University, which he will then go on to in his later years be the president of himself. His father desperately wanted him to enter the ministry, but William Samuel Johnson, being somewhat headstrong in his own way, decided, no, I'm going to go into law. And so, as was the tradition of that day, there weren't law schools in those days, he taught himself law, passed the bar, and was admitted in Connecticut, where he practiced law. He served in the Connecticut militia from 1761 to 65, and he was also in the Colonial Assembly. In 1771, he was elected to the upper house in Connecticut, and at the time of the Revolution, he was disturbed by his conflicting loyalties. He attended the Stamp Act Congress in 1765. He was sort of against the Townshend duties of 1767, and he believed that most British policemen were unwise. But he had a lot of friends in England. He found it difficult to choose sides. He was British himself. 1765 and 1766, Oxford University conferred honorary degrees and doctorate degrees on him. And he had strong associations with the Anglican Church. He acted as Connecticut's agent in Britain during the years 1767 to 1771. And he was good friends with men who were in the British government. He had finally decided to work for peace between Britain and the colonies and to oppose the Whig faction. He refused to participate in the First Continental Congress, even though he had been elected to it in 1774. He had been a judge on the Connecticut Colonial Supreme Court, and when hostilities broke out, he confined his activities to peacemaking efforts. In April of 1775, just as the war had started, Connecticut sent him and another emissary to speak to British General Thomas Gage about ending the bloodshed. But, as you know, time was not ripe for negotiations and everything failed. Johnson fell out of favor with the radical patriot elements who had gained ascendancy in the Connecticut government, and they no longer paid any attention to him. They just sort of put him out to pasture. He was arrested in 1779 on charges of communicating with the enemy, but he was a pretty good lawyer. He cleared himself and ended up being released. After the war was over, he resumed his political career. He served in the Continental Congress from 1785 to 1787, and he was one of the most influential and popular delegates to Congress. He went to the Constitutional Convention, arriving on June the 2nd, and missed zero sessions from that point forward. He was in favor of the Connecticut Compromise, as you will learn, and he will chair the Committee of Style, which will shape the final document. He also will go back to home to Connecticut, where he will work very hard for ratification of the Constitution by his home state of Connecticut. After the Constitution is ratified, he will become a U.S. Senator. He will contribute to the passage of the Judiciary Act in 1789. And in 1791, when the government moves from New York to Philadelphia, he resigns, mainly because he prefers to devote his duties back to his presidency of Columbia College. During his final years there, he will make Columbia College the preeminent college of its day. He'll retire in 1800 and remarry. His first wife had passed away. He'll remarry in 1800 as well. And for the next 19 years, he will remain at his birthplace in Stratford, Connecticut, where he will finally pass away at the age of 92. And he will be buried in the old Episcopal Cemetery there, where he resides. These are the kind of men that we're going to talk about. Men whose names you may have heard in passing at some point in your life, but really, do you know anything at all about them? Do you know what they did or why they matter or any of those kinds of things that have been lost to us to history? And yet, if we're going to say that we're going to study the Constitution, we really have to know who these people were. And of course, Johnson's not the only one. He just happens to be one of the more interesting guys, I think, in the sense that here's a fellow who did not really actively participate in the American Revolution. He was, you know, older in ages. He was in his 50s, 40s and 50s during the Revolutionary War, and he just really wasn't on fire with revolutionary fervor. In fact, accused at one point of collaborating with the enemy. And yet, this is the man who will go on to really guide the writing, the actual stylistic writing of the actual document. And of course, he serves the nation and his college as well, and lives to a ripe old age of 92, which is very, very unusual, actually, amongst that. It's kind of interesting because we really don't think of these guys. We're constantly bombarded with this idea that lifespan has increased. You know, we lived a much riper old age and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, George Washington was 55 years old when this whole thing started. So it's an interesting, we're going to, like I said, we'll pull these guys in and you'll get to meet them a little bit more through their debate. From Delaware, a guy by the name of Gunning Bedford Jr. He was the fifth of seven children born in Philadelphia. He was descended from a distinguished family that had originally settled in Jamestown, Virginia, and usually referred to himself as Gunning Bedford Jr. to avoid confusion with his cousin and contemporary Delaware statesman and soldier, Colonel Gunning Bedford. You may have heard that name if you studied any of those things, but this is not him, and that's why he calls himself Junior. In 1771, he graduated with honors from the College of New Jersey, which would later become Princeton, where he was a classmate, actually, of James Madison. While he was in school, he got married, had kids, he read for law in Philadelphia, he won admittance to the bar and set up a practice. Later on, he moved to Dover, Delaware, and then to Wilmington, where he apparently served in the Continental Army, possibly as an aide to General Washington. These records of this era are so thin and spotty in some cases that we don't even know what we suspect that he served as an aide to Washington, but we don't really know. The record is not clear. Following the war, Bedford figures prominently in the politics of the state and nation. He sits in the legislature, the Continental Congress, and later was chosen as a delegate to the Annapolis Convention, but didn't go, as many people didn't, and later serves as the Attorney General of Delaware. He was one of the more active members of the Constitutional Convention. He did miss a few sessions. He was a pretty big guy. He had a loud voice, and on several occasions was a member of the committee that drafted the Great Compromise. He was an ardent small state advocate, of course he would be from Delaware, and he attacked the pretension of the large states over the small and warned that the latter might be forced to seek foreign alliances unless the new government accommodated their interests. He did attend the Delaware Ratifying Convention, and he is one of the, as I said, he's one of the advocates for this. He died at the age of 65 in 1812 and was buried in Wilmington, Delaware. Later, when the cemetery was abandoned, his body was transferred to the Masonic House at the Lancaster Turnpike in Christian Hundred, Delaware. So if you ever go out that way, you might want to drop by and see old Gunning Bedford Jr. and understand that he is part of the reason we have a Constitution of the United States of America. It's Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bellman Show. Over the next 5 months, as we look at some of these names and some of these folks who you will hopefully get to know much more intensely, much more critically, and most of all, I'm hoping that this will kind of open our eyes in a way. Because again, and I'm guilty of this over the last, I don't know, well, since 2010, with regards to Constitution Thursday, so rarely do we actually go back to the actual debates of that day. We do it every now and then. But we tend to focus more on the Federalist Papers for what we consider to be originalist views and court rulings for interpretation beyond that and how it's been applied beyond that. So I'm hoping that this will be something of interest to you, and I'm hoping that you'll enjoy it. I don't want to spend, you know, we're not going to do everybody's biography. We've got 5 months to do all of these, and as people come up in the debates, we'll talk more about them in particular. But there was one more name I wanted to give you before we got out of here today. Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer. How many of you knew that one of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention was a guy by the name of Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer? He was from Maryland. He was Swedish and English descent. He was from Charles County, Maryland, which again is important to me. That's where my original Holt side of my family, my mother's side of the family, came to America as well in Charles County. Pretty much nobody knows anything about his childhood or his education, but somehow or another he got a large estate near Annapolis, and it's called Stepney, where he lived most of his life. He never married, and his far-reaching friendships included such illustrious personages as George Washington. I guess with a name like Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, you kind of would make a lot of friends, wouldn't you? He was an agent when he was a young man, a receiver general for the last two proprietors of Maryland. He filled a post of Justice of the Peace in Charles County and later for the Western Circuit of Maryland. In 1760, he sat on a boundary commission that settled disputes between Pennsylvania and Delaware. And 6 years later, he became a member of the provincial court and later was on the Maryland Royal Governor's Council. Despite his association with conservative proprietary politics, Jennifer supported the revolutionary movement, albeit somewhat reluctantly at first. And I think we're going to find a lot of that. We're going to see a lot of guys that weren't all that anxious to rebel against England. But later on, they would become very good Americans. He served as the president of the Maryland Council of Safety in 75 and 77, and that's 1700, and later as president of the first state senate. He also was in the first, or sat in the Continental Congress from 1778 to 1782, and he was in the position of state revenue and financial manager from 82 to 85. So you know this guy's he's an accountant, and he's a good, you know, obviously well trusted. He was a conservative nationalist. He favored a strong and permanent union of the states, and a Congress with taxation power. Ooh, that's going to become a big issue, isn't it? In 1785, he represented Maryland at the Mount Vernon Conference. Although he was one of 29 delegates who attended nearly every session of the Continental Convention, he didn't speak very often, but often backed Madison and the nationalist element. He only lived 3 years after the convention, and he never held public office, dying at the age of 66 or possibly 67 in Annapolis. The exact location of his grave is completely unknown today. No one knows where Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer is buried. He's lost to our history. As we begin to know these men, as we begin to see what they did, we need to recall that on May 14, 1787, eight of them managed to gather in Philadelphia at what will become known as the convention opens. It is, again, a crowded, dirty city. The convention is actually next door, basically, to a prison where there will be some humorous things happening along the way, particularly with Dr. Franklin as he walks by. But it's, or is carried by more appropriately. And as this convention begins to roll forward, and as the summer heats up, the arguments will become very intense, the debates will become very pointed, and even in some cases heated, but almost never personal. The character of the 55 men that are involved here is above anything that we can even imagine today. There are different views about how things should run. There are differing ideas about what needs to happen. There are ideas about who should be doing things. But they never let that go to a personal attack level, which is kind of fascinating if you think about it, because, again, it was the 1780s. Personal hygiene issues were handled much differently in that era. There were, you know, it's a big city. Philadelphia, it was a dirty city. And yet, they seem to maintain that dignity, and even to a lesser degree, the sense of humor. As they go through this process, they will, of course, result in the document that we're talking about, the Constitution of the United States. They will then present that to us, the people of the United States, for our approval. 55 men we're going to talk about. We're going to follow their debates. We're going to, insofar as we're able to, read them, discuss them. Some of them will have more time to spend on than others. We only have, 45 minutes a week to delve into this. But we'll summarize each Thursday. We'll summarize the previous week of 1787 and what they talked about, some of the more important issues, and we'll look at what the men who wrote the Constitution, said about what they were actually doing at that point. Hopefully you'll find this fascinating. But on May 14, 1787, basically all the roads into Philadelphia at that point were rivers of mud. And while Madison had arrived 10 days earlier on May 3rd, there was no way everybody was going to make it on time. He blamed the weather and excused it. And in fact, they will meet tomorrow on the 15th of May, and there will be enough of them that they will elect George Washington as the president of the council in one of the most predictable, moves in all of history. They will elect George Washington as the president of the Constitutional Convention. Nobody was surprised by that. Nobody was shocked by that. But it will be another week before they will actually begin to start delving into the actual debates of what they're going to do. And what they're going to do is so important that Dr. Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, will actually say this about the convention that's about to happen. Quote, "Indeed, if it does not do good, it must do harm, as it will show that we have not the wisdom enough amongst ourselves to govern ourselves, and will strengthen the opinion of some political writers that popular governments cannot long support themselves." The old world watches what's going on in Philadelphia with doubt that they will be able to pull this off. The nation itself understands that the men have gathered there to try and fix some of the problems that they have with their government, and that if they don't fix them, the problems that they're facing, the economic issues that they're facing, are going to probably get much worse. And the short little experiment known as the United States of America, the 13 United States of America, will have failed in just a few short years. That's what's at stake on May 14th, 1787. Failure, as we've talked about, will mean the end of the United States. And of course, to us, this seems unthinkable today. It seems like it was a foreordained issue of history. But of course, in 1787, that was not the case. People were unsure of what was going to happen. The rest of the world looked on with varying degrees of support and or interest. England, of course, would benefit greatly if the Constitutional Convention fails and we dissolve essentially as a union of 13 states. As I've said, how the nation would have broken up is subject to speculation, whether it would have been regional in some cases or individual states in others. It's hard to say for sure. Some states would have had to go with another just to survive. As we talked about, North Carolina, stuck between Virginia and South Carolina, would have probably had to go with one of those two states, if not both of them. However it would have broken up, it would have been a much different nation than it was today, than it is today. The other issue to keep in mind, and this is something that I very firmly believe, and it's something that I teach as often as I can. One of the biggest mistakes that people make about the convention and the Constitution in general is that it was, quote, written by a bunch of rich white guys for white men. Nothing could be further from the truth. And anybody who takes the time to read what we're going to read over the next 5 months, what we're going to talk about over the next 5 months, to hear the debates and the discussion over the next 5 months, could ever possibly come to that conclusion. So anybody that tells you that that's the case, you can automatically assume that they have never read these things, and they certainly haven't studied them. The fact of the matter is that the convention and those who are there are as divided politically as we are today. But they understand above all else that the social ills, particularly slavery, is not going to be solved unless there is a union. If the nation divides, slavery will remain. And indeed, in some parts of the world, it will remain well into the 1880s, legally. There is, of course, slavery today, but as a general rule, it's not legal. But even in the 1880s in South America, it will remain legal in some countries. It's very possible that if the nation breaks apart, if the United States dissolve their union, that slavery never does get ended, at least not in the foreseeable future of that day. And this is why part of the understanding that we need to have of why this is so important is that the men who were there weren't interested in just securing rights and liberties for white gentlemen, but they understood that in order to reach a point where these rights extended to all human beings, as promised in the Declaration of Independence, required that the Union be maintained, and that failure to do so would eliminate all of that. It would make it impossible. And that's why what's about to happen here in Philadelphia is so important and remains so even to this day. So that's what we're going to do for the next 5 months on Constitution Thursday. We're going to go through the convention. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time and thought what a great opportunity to start on May 14th and proceed from there. It's Constitution Thursday. It's Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bellman Show.
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bellman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Copyright MMXV. All rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.